boots softly clanking to the clean room for a final inspection. Beyond the clean room were two sets of metal doors, and beyond those, the testing field. Lieutenant Olivia Curson was just as fed up with the blackout base as Niles was. She'd met Niles in the rec hall. They'd drunk a beer together, chatted, and she'd noticed how unfailingly respectful Niles was. Respectful, but never obsequious. Of course, she outranked him. But that didn't stop some enlisted guys from leering at her after they had a couple of beers. Niles never leered, never spoke condescendingly, never tried innuendo. And he met her eyes steadily when they spoke. His own eyes were sky blue. They talked again when she was brought into armor testing, after she'd read his file. His military history intimidated her. She'd seen barely any combat, and he'd been steeped in it. Then there was Spivus, Captain Spivus, who'd smuggled a fifth of wild turkey into the base. The booze was contraband, even for officers on a blackout base, because a drunk man, off duty or not, forgot what high security was all about. And he forgot how to behave around women officers, too. Which was why she'd had to knee the captain in the groin when he waylaid her behind the mess hall. She'd cracked his nuts hard enough to make him yelp. He'd staggered away and barfed on a flagpole in front of a major. He claimed later she'd come on to him and kneed him when he turned her down. But Niles, passing by, had seen the whole thing. He stepped up on his own to testify for her. Stood up in military court against a captain and General Dalt. Irvin Dalt, who just happened to be Spivus's drinking buddy. Niles had a silver cross, a bronze star, and three purple hearts. Every decent man at Area 57 looked up to him. So Spivus lost the case and got himself shipped to a radar base in the Arctic. Now she glanced at Dalt, a paunchy, jowly, middle-aged man in a perfectly ironed, excessively starched uniform. Dalt cracked his knuckles, his tongue tracing the edges of his teeth. What was Dalt's real motivation, she wondered, in setting up this particular test? They'd already tested the suit a dozen ways, put it through incredible stresses. The enemy they were to test the suit against today, while formidable, was unarmed. The whole thing seemed like a pointless exercise to her. Unless the point was retaliation aimed at Niles for testifying against Spivus. Across the field, just above the gate that would release the Yautja, two snipers stood on a platform just behind the curved wall. One of them was Cliff Javits, another sycophant of General Dalt's. Javits had been caught by an IED back in Afghanistan. He was missing his right ear and the right-hand section of his lower nose, fully exposing a nostril. Rumor had it his personality had changed after the IED due to traumatic brain injury. He was as psychopathic a man as Olivia had ever met, though he did nothing he could be convicted for. The other sniper was Earl Smithson, a black man who rarely spoke. Presumably the snipers were there to protect Niles from the Yautja, should the armor malfunction or the creature get the upper hand. Below, the doors from the clean room opened, and they watched as Niles stepped into the dull late afternoon sunlight of the acre-wide testing field. Niles's movements in the armor weren't quite as free as a man in field camis, but free enough. Olivia wondered how far up in the chain of command Dalt had gone to get approval for this. Maybe he hadn't gotten any, anywhere. Far as she knew, this Yautja was the only living extraterrestrial in custody. There was a whole exobiology team in this building studying the Yautja through hidden cameras, watching it exercising, eating, pacing. Eliminating wastes. Using DNA testing and remote body scans, they'd worked out what to feed it, how its body worked. She knew the entire exo team was mad as hell about this little gladiatorial setup. Suppose the alien got badly injured or killed. They had already dissected other dead Yautjas. They wanted this one alive. But Dalt had overruled them. He had always been an arrogant son of a bitch. And he insisted this fight was going to be part of their research on these interplanetary predators. The Yautja wasn't likely to get killed, he said. But from the reports Olivia had read, these things were fast and deadly, Suppose it slipped past Niles's defenses and killed him. Her heart thudded as she watched the gate open, and the Yoja showing itself in the passage opposite Niles. At first it crouched in the shadows of the passage, its hooded yellow-red eyes and mandibles gleaming. Felt different facing this thing up close and personal, instead of seeing it through an unbreakable window. Its cold, inhuman intelligence gave him chills. Niles had the plasma caster gripped in his right hand, the weapon hooked to a power source in his armor by a jointed metal tube, and it could be attached to a pivoter on his right shoulder, more or less like the Yoja. But they hadn't worked out the shoulder-based aiming as well as the Yoja had, and Niles preferred to keep the weapon in his hand. Then the Predator shuffled slowly out into the circular testing field, turning its head this way and that, the mane-like thick dangle of hair about its bald, mottled head waving a little with its motions. It was assessing, calculating, taking in the high, slick, inward-slanting walls, the snipers, the gate closing behind Niles. And then the Yo just stared directly at its adversary. It looked Niles up and down. Then the Predator hunched down and spread its arms like an old-style wrestler, making low, glutinous clicking sounds deep in its throat. Niles did his own assessing. The thing was at least a head taller than he was. It had claws. But otherwise the Yoja was apparently unarmed. It did have some chest armor, and that net-like material over its limbs that would project its camouflage. Its muscles rippled powerfully under skin that looked like something he'd seen on a desert toad. It had some form of gauntlet, but no plasma caster. How should he handle this? He didn't have orders to kill it. Just engage the alien, as Dalt put it. It's got no reason not to kill me if it can. Then it opened its mouth, its jaws opening wide, showing the big fangs that pointed almost inwardly, the red-webbed mouth. And he was looking down the Predator's throat as it lunged, roaring at him. Niles quickly sidestepped, and then realized the Yoja had only been fainting, pretending to be coming at him to see how quickly he reacted, see if he could be startled into freezing. "That's not going to work, Crabface," he told it. The armor had responded well, enhancing his movements, but not overdoing the enhancement. It responded to his remark. Niles had heard the creatures sometimes parroted human speech. "Not going to work," came the mocking voice. Niles squared himself, trying to get his head clear, his pulse down. Focus, and maybe get this over with early. Get it to accept defeat. He pointed the plasma caster and fired. Niles hadn't aimed directly at the creature. Not supposed to kill it. He aimed at the ground just in front of its clawed feet to give it a warning and knock it back with a shockwave. But by the time the blast hit the ground, the Yoja wasn't there. It had switched on its active camouflage, was all but invisible. He caught a barely visible cubistic outline of it. As far faster than he'd given it credit for, the Yoja leapt over the plasma caster's blast trajectory, coming right at him, whipping metal spikes from its left-hand gauntlet at his helmet. Niles overreacted in his surprise, stumbled back, fell on his back. And then it was on him, its knees on his chest. It had triggered the long barbed metal gougers from its left gauntlet. It did have a weapon. He could glimpse light reflecting from it, despite the electronic camouflage. It slammed the heavy barbed gougers at his faceplate, the transparent layers protecting his face held, but Niles felt like his head was inside a ringing church bell, and he could sense the strain in the helmet. It slammed the gougers down again. Was that a crack in the corner of his faceplate? Struggling to shove the creature off him, Niles swung hard up at the Yoja's head with his mailed left fist. But the Yoja, red-yellow eyes glowing with kill-lust, blocked it easily with the gauntlet. The blow somehow switched off its camouflage, and he saw it all too well, roaring at him, its eyes bright with hate as it slammed his helmet again with the gougers. The snipers were up there on the wall. Why didn't they at least wing the Yoja? The Yoja raised its tautly muscled left fist, gathering its strength, preparing to smash his faceplate. Niles was reluctant to disobey orders, but he was going to have to shoot this thing off him. He aimed the plasma caster at it almost point-blank, but it grabbed the caster by the muzzle, used all its strength and its better positioning to turn the weapon, just as the caster fired, right where it wanted the plasma beam to go. The top of the enclosing wall on the right shattered. A piece of shattered wall struck the alien, and its grip was loosened for a moment. Niles got his right knee bent, braced his foot under his hip, and used the whole force of the leg, his and the armor's force, to fling the alien away. The Yautja roared as it was thrown back, and Niles felt a wrenching in his suit. He lost the grip on his gun. He rolled, got quickly to his feet, and saw that the plasma caster was no longer in his hand. The Yautja had it, had snapped its connective cable. It was crouching, aiming the caster at the sniper platform. Neither sniper was in sight now. It fired, blasting more of the upper wall away, then turned the weapon toward Niles. But he knew something the creature didn't. The human-engineered version of the caster was fed by the cable. It only stored one shot at a time in its load chamber, and the Yautja had used that shot. The gun failed to fire, and the alien tossed it away. It slashed at Niles with its gougers. He blocked the blow with his right hand, smashed at the thing with his left, caught it on the side of its head. Its luminous yellow-green blood spurted from a scalp wound. He circled it, and it rushed him, slashing. He jumped aside, but it had simply gotten him out of the way. It jumped to the break in the wall and pulled itself over. Niles bounded after it, jumped, but it could jump higher than he could. He couldn't catch the lower edge of the break in the wall. Cursing, he dropped back. Someone up there screamed. A gun fired. Then there was silence, except for the base's alarms going off. Sitting on the table, Niles held the helmet in his hand, looking it over as Olivia came in. Scratch on the faceplate, but no crack, he told Ramirez. It wouldn't have taken much more. Smithson is dead, Olivia told him, as Ramirez checked over the armor. The first blast broke his collarbone, stunned him. Then the thing killed him. Javits is alive. He shot at it, but it was smoky in there. Not a good place for a sniper rifle, and he missed. It ducked out a fire door and killed two sentries. Just tore into them. She took a deep breath. Niles nodded. Thanks for letting me know, Lieutenant. I'm sorry about Smithson. He was a good soldier. It wasn't your fault, she said. The alien breached the wall, not you. Lieutenant's right, Ramirez said, taking the helmet and looking it over. No one thought the wall was that vulnerable. But it was old. That wall's thinner at the top, in that spot, to make room for the platform. Seems to me, Niles said, that weapon was powered up about double what it should have been for that situation. He felt tired, dispirited. 3 good men dead so far. It was powered up to where the general told me it should be, Ramirez said. I kind of wondered about it. You didn't tell me. I thought, more power, better for you, Sarge. Yeah. No one told me it had those gougers. Olivia nodded sharply at that. I was told it had no weapons. I kind of thought the snipers would have taken it out when it was on top of me. That angle, they could have put a couple of fist-sized holes right through its head. Olivia looked angrily at the door. I had the same thought. Javits says he was told not to fire unless the general gave him the order. The door opened. Maybe Olivia had been expecting someone. General Dalt. He looked pale and a little scared. Sergeant Niles, that thing's just killed another sentry. Cooper shot at it, missed, and it gutted him. Took him a while to die. Niles winced inwardly. He should have kept that thing bottled up. But no one had told him it had a weapon, and he'd been told not to kill it with the plasma caster. Still, it was his job to knock the thing down and keep it under control. Dalt seemed ready to confirm what Niles was thinking. This is on you, Niles. Put that helmet back on. Get a jeep and get out there. He hasn't got the caster, Ramirez objected. It'll take me a whole day to fix it. Tough. He's got the armor. Everything else in it works. He can take a rifle. Olivia shook her head.
Sir, what about an attack helicopter?
We've got armored vehicles. Negative. That thing is headed to town. It's dark out. And by the time we track it, it's going to be out there with civilians around. We're not firing any rockets into any civilian towns, Lieutenant. No. This is on Niles.
Javits's head was throbbing, and the bandage was too damn tight, but he was already dressed by the time the general came to the infirmary.
You good for duty, Javits? Dalt asked.
Javits saluted.
I am, sir. Just a crease on the head. Nothing I ain't had before.
Requisition a rifle. We've got more to think about than just a runaway monster. What I'm hoping is, Niles gets the thing's attention, gets it cornered. Then you put a round through its leg. We recapture it. I'll send a backup team. You can call them when it's down. They'll be right behind you. Then, we shut all this up. No one needs to know how this shitstorm got its start.
Shut it up. How, sir?
I'm counting on you, Javits. I cannot trust Niles, see? Or Olivia Curson. You saw what happened. Niles testified against my man. Over a goddamn attempted rape accusation.
That kind of disloyalty.
He shook his head. Cannot trust him to keep his mouth shut. Anyway. Dalt went to the door, glanced out into the hall, looking both ways. He closed the door and came over to Javits. Dalt lowered his voice.
Niles is going to get caught in a crossfire. You understand me?
Javits thought about it.
It'd be good to have the general beholden to him. But this... kind of a risk to me, General, if this comes out.
You want a promotion? Special privileges?
For a start?
Dalt winced. Finally, he said, I can get you 10 grand on top of it.
And the lieutenant?
I'll send her out to check on him. If the alien doesn't get her, you make it look like it did anyway.
Double the risk. But promotion. Special privileges. Cash. Opportunity like this didn't come along too often. A man had to grab it by the tail.
After a moment, Javits nodded.
I'll get her done, General. But my rifle's not much use against that armor Niles is wearing.
That's right. It stands up to snipers, small arms fire of all kinds, grenade fragments, flamethrowers, mines, and most IEDs. But you think it'll protect him from a 30-millimeter cannon? He'll be pulverized inside it. Second shot'll blow it open. I'm giving you a striker outfitted with a cannon. Those things have some kind of self-destruct in their gauntlet. I don't want to suck on a small nuke. You don't think it would have used that by now if it had one? It was unconscious when we found it. We stripped that out of its gear. He sighed. Only thing I gave back to it was the chest armor, its camouflage, and those spikes in its gauntlet. Mistake to let it have the active cami. 30 millimeter. Only fired one once. It's pretty self-guided these days. Just try not to use it on the alien. Not unless you have to. Only don't let that thing get clean away, either. But make sure Niles is dead. Slam him with the shell dead center. We'll say he just plain got in the way.
It was dark by the time they'd picked up the trail. Just Ramirez driving the Humvee, and Niles suited up beside him. It's not headed for town, if the heat signature is right, Niles said. He could see its tracks glowing red in his helmet's infrared scan mode. It's changed directions.
What the hell for? Those things are into taking trophies, right? More trophies in town.
Ramirez winced, put his hand to his throat.
They take the head off, the skin off the skull.
There's a ranch out here, and there's Special Hangar 14 right past the ranch. I don't think it's going for any more trophies. It already took some. Security camera has it shoving the heads of 3 sentries in a duffel bag.
Oh, Christ. Cooper and Morris and Lampsky. I didn't know it.
He grimaced.
What's in Hangar 14, anyway?
above my pay grade. This situation, I guess you've got a right to know. They found the alien out cold after its vehicle was shot down. Built the hangar around the ship. They keep trying to take it apart without detonating it. It's got armament. Soon as they took the Yautja off, the ship started up some kind of defense protocol. Two techs got themselves fried by its plasma casters. So that's one time the rumors were true. Tracks are heading down that wash. Right along the road there. Take the road for now. Gage Binch had spent all afternoon clearing brush from the back acreage. He figured he could turn it into pasture. The acreage was right up against that tall fence topped with razor wire around the army outpost. Outpost 14. Gage doubted it was an outpost. It was a distance off, across a pretty wide stretch of asphalt. But he could see it well enough. A long, squat, gray metal building, with 2 50-foot-high metal roll-up doors. Place looked more like a hangar than an outpost. And those searchlights, those 4 sentry boxes. A lot of security for some little outpost. Plus the fact that the army MPs told him he was not to even get near the fence. Screw them. This was his land. This was a don't-tread-on-me situation. If he wanted to turn it to pasturage, that was his choice. He could hear his cattle mooing from the other side of the ranch house. Soon enough, he'd be able to put the new bull in with some cows and get another herd started. And he'd put it right here in the new pasture. He surveyed his work. 6 of those little desert trees cut down. Room to move his tractor in so he could push the rock out of the way. Lay down some soil for the grass. There was the old oak tree, likely to fall down on its own next big wind. But he had to leave it. Too close to that fence to mess with. And nearby the oak was a small fenced pasture where he kept the new Brahmin bull. Gage could see it tramping up and down, shaking its big horned head. Something was spooking it, seemed like. Maybe the chainsaw noise. But it was dark out. Time to go in, drink some scotch, have a talk with Regina. Of course his wife had died on him. But he talked to the urine of her ashes all the same. Maybe just cut that one snag. He had enough light with the electric lantern. Gage tugged his goggles into place, switched on the chainsaw, held it firmly in both hands, and cut through the snag on the scrub tree. Then a shadow cut off most of the light from his lantern. He turned. There was a big man there. He couldn't see the guy's face. Just a mane of some kind, a gnarly bald head, those strange hands, a bloody duffel bag lying on the ground beside it. Who the holy fu- Then the guy vanished, just sort of blinked out. What the hell? Was he having a stroke? He thought he caught some motion from the corner of his eyes, turned, in time to get a big military trench knife shoved through his belly. He stared down at it, stunned, exploding with pain, gurgling, the chainsaw still in his hands. He tried to swing the chainsaw toward the knifer, but the chainsaw was taken from him, all too easily pried from his grip. Then it reversed and came right at his throat. "Qué mierda," Ramirez burst out. He stopped the Humvee, and its headlights lit up the bloody, decapitated head of a bull. A gray-black Brahmin with thick, curving horns. The hulking head was stuck on a post to either side of the road leading up to the ranch house. Its jaws were open, lolling tongue dripping blood onto the gravel road. Its dead eyes were still shiny in the headlight glow. Niles's gut lurched at the sight. Guess it didn't have room in that duffel for the bull's head, so it figured to scare us off.
Yeah,
it'd work on me too if I was out here alone, Sarge. Ramirez accelerated slowly past the staring bull's head, peering at the cactus garden in front of the ranch house. Damn thing could be anywhere out here with that camouflage. Niles switched on his infrared vision, saw nothing but what appeared to be an owl sitting in a saguaro. But there, to the right, maybe a trail of blood, traces of footsteps. He switched to night vision instead. The dark landscape lit up in greens and yellows. No sign of the Yautja. Pull up. Roll the windows down. Ramirez pulled up. The windows hummed down.
I hear something. Like a... Is that a chainsaw?
Yeah. Must be how it cut through that bull. He was probably watching someone using it, and they're dead about now. Go slow, around to the right. There's a road to the back. They drove around the dark ranch house, Niles considering cutting the headlights. And then they saw something big, bigger than the alien, shifting, falling. It was an oak tree tipping over onto the high razor-topped fence around the Hangar 14 compound. The big tree fell with a clinking crunch they could hear through the open windows. Ramirez picked up speed, drove toward it, bumping over cut shrubs and plant debris. Then Niles spotted it, in pale gray outline. The Yautja, climbing up the slanting trunk of the fallen tree, which had fallen on the fence. It had cut down the tree with the rancher's chainsaw, giving it away past the guards at the outer sentry box. The Yautja was already running now, across the asphalt, going into active camouflage, the canvas bag of trophies showing over one shoulder, as if the bloody duffel were flying along alone.
That thing is crazy smart, said Ramirez.
We've got to get word to 14. I'll have to go through Dalt. Niles spoke the code word that would voice-activate his radio and heard its line crackle open. Mark 3 calling base, code 23, connect me with General Dalt. He waited. The line crackled with static. No response. Maybe the damn helmet was damaged after all, Niles said. Try the Hummer's radio. Ramirez picked up the mic, clicked the on button. No response. He checked the dashboard radio unit.
Someone's cut the wires. This radio's dead, Sarge. We're in this alone.
Maybe not alone, Niles said. I just spotted a drone flying over.
Is it armed?
Just an observation drone. The General doesn't want to hear from us, seems like. But he wants to keep an eye on us. Let's jam through where the fence is down. There was just enough room to drive the Humvee through, following the Yautja. Niles hoped the fallen razor wire wasn't going to wreck the Humvee's tires. But it kept on, rumbling over the broken fence and onto the asphalt. Some nervous Nelly at the checkpoints might open fire on us, Ramirez said. Someone's got to have told them. That's when the cannon shell struck the Humvee. 1 second they were driving steadily toward the looming light-streaked hangar. The next was all fire and splintering glass and the world flipping sideways. The Humvee pitched over, Ramirez yelling wordlessly, falling down on Niles. The Humvee rocked and settled on its right side. The windshield was partly smashed out in front of Niles. Smoke was thickening, and Ramirez was groaning. Niles said, Mark 3, full operation! Lights flickered inside his helmet. He reached up, pushed out the metal rooftop hatch and wriggled through, then pulled Ramirez out by his collar, Ramirez shrieking in pain. He got him out, just as the Humvee lit up like a bonfire. Carrying Ramirez in his arms, Niles hurried away from the Humvee before the rest of the gas tank went up. Niles turned, saw flame geysering, lighting the area around the burning wreck. It quickly died back, but there was no getting into that Humvee, which meant that Niles had no weapon now. His assault rifle was in that burning Humvee. But then, his armor was itself a weapon. He could batter down a metal door with it, or an enemy's skull. Ramirez went limp in Niles' arms. He laid him gently on the ground, switched on a helmet light, and saw broken bones jutting up, pink and yellow from the corporal's chest. A blankness was coming into his eyes, as if the night around them were pooling in the sockets. Ramirez was dead before Niles straightened up. In a cold fury now, Niles looked around, spotted the striker, its lights off, swinging toward him, the cannon centering itself, maybe 40 yards off. That looked like a 30-millimeter cannon swiveling toward him. A direct hit, and his suit would crack open like a lobster shell under a hammer. Niles ran left, his boots clanking, the armored suit working overtime. Then he zigged to the right. The cannon's muzzle tracked to compensate, and Niles changed direction again, then leapt. As the shell hit the ground behind him, the shockwave lifting him, pitching him head over heels. He came down on his back, dazed, ears ringing, but intact. "You missed, you prick," he growled. He rolled over, saw the smoking blast crater in the asphalt. He got up, ran to the crater, flattened down, and tried to recon the field. Who the hell was in the Striker? Dalt? No, too risky. Most likely Dalt's bully boy Javits, using a weapon that could be sure to bust through the Mark III armor in a direct hit. Niles switched on the infrared, hoping to pick up a body shape in the Striker. No good. The Striker's armor was too thick. But he picked up another figure, silhouetted in red. The Yautja, moving toward the armored vehicle from its rear. No mistaking that outline. It had ditched the chainsaw, still held the duffel bag, and there was something else in its hand. The distinct shape of a Special Forces issue combat knife. Long, partly serrated, vicious. What the Predator had used to take the heads from the sentries at the base. The Striker was moving, coming slowly, implacably toward Niles, the cannon tracking, wanting that direct hit. But then the infrared outline of the Yautja was hunched atop the armored car. It was going after whoever was in that vehicle. Why them in particular? But maybe it was the Striker it wanted. Niles switched on his night vision, saw the creature more clearly, a glowing white-gray shape tugging at a hatch, figuring out how to open it. The hatch swung back. Driver had neglected to lock it. The Striker suddenly stopped as if the driver had realized someone was breaking in on him and wanted to deal with it. Niles jumped up, ran toward the Striker, making sure he was angling to keep out of the cannon's current firing zone. He was aware of shapes moving beyond the Striker's windshield, a flurry of movement. Then a pair of headlights swung into his path, and a car came straight at him. He had no way to evade the car in time. But it stopped, brakes screeching. A moment, then Olivia Kirsten got partly out of it, waving for him. "Come on, Niles, now!" He rushed to the car, his boots clanking on the asphalt. He was aware of sentries in the distance, shouting from the front of Hangar 14. Flashlights, men shouting orders, other men arguing. Niles stopped by the car. Maybe he should remove his helmet, ID himself. "Niles, get in!" Olivia yelled, getting behind the wheel. Niles looked toward the Striker, and then saw it had turned away from him. It was rumbling toward the hangar. It knows how to drive it. Can it figure out how to fire the cannon? Niles reached the car, climbed in beside her, having to move the seat all the way back. There was barely room for him in his armor. "Turn this car around," he shouted, not caring about rank right now. She brought the car around, started toward the hangar, then had to jog the wheel, skidding to avoid a headless body lying on the asphalt. Niles caught a glimpse of a sniper specialist insignia on the corpse's shoulder. Javits. Up ahead, the Striker was picking up speed, the big armored car going faster and faster, heading for the big doors of the hangar. The cannon remained silent. He guessed it didn't have time to figure out the firing interface. "I think Dalt's trying to kill you." "Maybe me too," Olivia said as she drove toward the hangar. Her voice was taut, her knuckles white on the steering wheel. "Be a good guess. And the Yautja's got hold of that Striker." "Oh, no. It couldn't." "It did. Slow down. We're liable to catch some fire from our own people." She hit the brakes. The car fishtailed to a stop about 20 yards from the hangar, where men were firing. But not at them, at the onrushing Striker. Niles could see bullets sparking from the titanium sheathing. Then the Striker plowed over two riflemen and kept going, crunching head-on into the big metal doors, smashing partway through, then grinding to a halt. Stuck. Its wheels kept spinning in place. "Pull over there, around the corner of the building. I'm going in the personnel door." The front end of the vehicle had jammed partway through the big reinforced doors. Still, the escapee was able to climb out the door on the right, then leap at the nearest onrushing primate to bear him down before he could fire his weapon. Its blade flashed, slashed, and the primate soldier was jerking in death. The escapee picked up the automatic weapon, turned it to the men guarding the spacecraft, and squeezed the trigger, spraying awkwardly at the enemy across the brightly lit concrete floor. They scrambled for cover, though the clip was quickly empty, useless. The escapee could see its landing craft, waiting, scarred but functional in the middle of the hangar. But an enemy projectile struck the escapee in the right side. It ignored the pain, turned and vaulted over the front of the armored vehicle, dropping to cover. Then it reached through the shattered window, pulled out the well-stuffed, bloody duffel bag. Now. The escapee growled to itself, switched on its active camouflage, and then sprinted, with projectiles banging and ricocheting around it, to the landing craft. The ramp was down, the door open. That much they had achieved. But after they had taken out their unconscious Yoja prisoner, the vessel went immediately into self-protection mode. It had been keeping the enemy at a distance ever since, tolerating scans and superficial observations, but not allowing disassembly. Now that a Yoja master was in sight again, the vessel lit up, as if in welcome. The landing craft's gun muzzles emerged and fired plasma bursts at the primate creatures, burning two of them to bubbling ashes, driving the others away. By now, the landing craft would be contacting the cloaked mothership. Indifferent to the pain of its wound, the escapee roared in joy and ran up to the ramp into its landing craft, thinking, "What glorious trophies I have." But it had one more duty to carry out before it could leave this wretched planet. Using full armor power, Niles smashed down the locked personnel door, ran into the blazingly lit hangar, switched off his night vision in time to see the Yoja running up the ramp into the alien vessel. The craft was about 80 feet long, 50 wide. It was shaped like the spade of a shovel, with intricate aft parts and insectoid metal legs holding it over the floor. The ramp was still down. If he could get to it, penetrate the vehicle, he could stop the Yoja from escaping. The Mark III might protect him from the ship's defenses. Long enough. And then he heard the helmet's computer speaking to him. External control engaged. What? His legs suddenly stopped moving. To be precise, the armor's legs stopped, so his own had to stop inside them. The armor was frozen in place. What external control is that? Origin unknown, centered in the mechanism directly ahead. The Yoja craft? Then Niles remembered they'd copied some of Mark III's circuits directly from the Yoja's gear. It was responding to the alien's control wavelength, stopping him where he was. The ramp lifted up, folded into the craft. The underside began to glow. A fat burst of energy turned everything blue-white. Niles felt a wave of heat. He heard the screams of men who couldn't get out of the way. He was in a cloud of energy that threatened to burn through his armor. The ceiling of the hangar exploded upward, the blowback clearing the air around the Mark III. And Niles could see again. He looked up, watching the Yoja craft levitating, its legs folding up under it, then arcing up, up on a pillar of energy. Gone. The computer in his suit said, "Control returned to primary user." Niles felt the armor's limbs unlock. He felt a gush of cool, filtered air drawn in, cooling him down. Sweat running down his face, he turned and walked toward Olivia Curson, who was bending over a soldier, trying to give him battlefield first aid. Half an hour later, they drove out past the long line of ambulances, back toward the blackout base. Niles had removed his helmet and gauntlets, wiping sweat with the back of his hand. "Ramirez. He's dead." She nodded. "He really looked up to you. Another guy I should have saved. You can't be blamed for a round from somebody else's cannon." They didn't speak again till they were almost back at the blackout base. She glanced at him. "What'll you do now?" "Testify against Dalt." "You?"
"Same."
"After that?"
"Request relief from the army. I'm done."
She stopped the car on a shoulder, turned to him, took his hands in hers.
"Look, I..."
The flash of blue light made them turn toward the base, squinting against the glare, just in time to see the administrative building explode. The building burned. Dalt was sure to be burning with it. Then another flash of light, A red beam fired from high above, destroying the exo-team's building. Niles and Olivia watched, open-mouthed, as the Yoach's spacecraft buzzed over the smoking wreckage, as if inspecting its handiwork, and came toward them. It seemed to hesitate above them for a moment, and Niles waited for the blast. It was too late to run. He hoped it'd be over quickly. But then the craft backed away, hovered wobblingly, and shot up into the sky, vanishing into the thin cloud cover, gone from this wretched planet. After a long, breathless moment, Olivia drove them back on the road toward the base to see if they could be of any help. But up ahead a roadblock was being set up. MPs waved them away. Silently, she turned the car around and they drove away from the blackout base. Fire trucks passed them, emergency crews in trucks from the external outposts.
"Why," he asked hoarsely, "didn't it blow us up too?"
"My guess?" She cocked her head, thinking. "It seemed to know who you were. Someone worth fighting. The way a real warrior fights. Maybe another time. But not that way, from a distance. So, it was about respect." "Maybe," he thought. "Maybe so." "Let's go into town," he said. "I want to get out of this suit. And then, I want a drink. Or three." "Never was any doubt of that," she said, as she turned on to the main highway.
Three Sparks by Larry Coria. They found the first bodies around noon, suspended from a branch high above them, arms dangling. Samurai? They could not tell. It was hard to know someone's social status after they had been skinned. From the bloat and the stink, combined with the heat, Hiroto guessed they had been dead for 3 days. He had skinned a lot of game, so even in their sorry state, he could tell that this Oni was very skilled at butchery. Hiroto was impressed. There were no signs of rope. It would take an incredible amount of strength and balance to haul corpses all the way up there. He had seen great cats cache their kills in trees, but this felt different. As if staged for their benefit. Was it to send a message? Marking territory? He tried not to let his appreciation show. A regular porter should be frightened, so he tried to act that way. The others, however, didn't have to act.
"Captain Nasu Hiroto, hero of the Battle of Danoura, hero of the Battle of Kurikara, master swordsman, and champion archer of the Minamoto clan. Some say the finest archer in our history, if not, second only to his father. Yet after the war, there would be no peace for him. No. Hiroto took one of my ships and was carried about wherever the waves would take him, always searching for a new battle, for new beasts to slay. Over the years, I heard he was hunting tigers in the jungles of Tenjiku, or great white bears in the desolate lands north of Joseon. It is widely believed Nasu Hiroto is the greatest hunter in the world." There were some exaggerations there, but Hiroto did not correct the shogun's inaccuracies. When the most powerful man in Nippon wanted to ramble, you let him. So Hiroto simply knelt and waited for Minamoto Yoritomo to pronounce his judgment. "You were one of my most trusted warriors, Hiroto. Why did you leave? After our victory over the Taira clan, I would have given you great responsibilities." "I left because you would have given me great responsibilities. Your life was mine to spend, Hiroto. Spending it teaching children how to use a bow would have been a waste. I am not trying to be facetious, my lord, but I would have died of boredom. I am not very good at peace." "Then you picked a fortuitous time to return." The castle was stifling. It was a miserable day in what had to be the hottest summer in generations.
A servant was fanning the red-faced and sweating shogun. Nobody was fanning Hiroto. He did not rate a fan.
I should have you executed for your disobedience, you impudent Ronin bastard. Yet curiosity gets the better of me. After all these years, you return to Kamakura. Why?
I received word that the shogunate has need of my services. Minamoto Yoritomo chuckled.
I should have known that the Oni of Aoki Gahara would bring you out of hiding. Summer began with it murdering a score of my warriors, picking them off one by one, and leaving them hanging from trees, skinned. Since then, samurai have been rushing there in order to defeat it and win my favor. All have failed. Witnesses whisper of an invisible demon, stronger than any man, which kills by spear, claw, or even bolts of lightning, before vanishing as quickly as it appeared. You can see how such stories would catch my interest, my lord. Sometimes, three glowing embers appear upon its chosen victim.
The shogun held up three fingers, then put them against his forehead, fingertips making the points of a triangle.
Being marked by these fire kami are the only warning before it strikes. So many samurai have perished that they believe the Oni cannot be defeated by a mortal hand. I seem to recall they said the same thing about the great sea beast, before your father killed it with a single arrow through the eye. A truly heroic moment. I know. I was there. No man has ever equaled his feat, including the man who has hunted every dangerous beast beneath the sun. Perhaps if you were to defeat the Oni of Aoki Gahara, you could finally match his legend?
It might have been in his blood, but that wasn't why Hiroto followed his path. The shogun may have been a brilliant general, but he did not understand the compulsion to constantly seek out new dangers.
You are wise, my lord. But what is one little forest demon when compared to a mighty kaiju? You could never resist a challenge, could you, Hiroto?
He had never fought a demon before.
No, my lord. I could not.
It was a few days' ride to Aoki Gahara, the dense forest to the north of Mount Fuji. Despite the blistering sun, Hiroto enjoyed seeing the land of his birth again. He felt eager and alive. Each morning the mountain was a bit closer, and so was his next great challenge. Unfortunately, he was not making the journey alone. The shogunate had sent a representative, a young warrior born of high status named Ashikaga Motokane, and his retinue of 5 bodyguards. Though Hiroto had helped their lord rise to power, that had been a long time ago. Now the shogun's samurai looked upon him as a dishonorable outcast, a wild man, an anomaly in their orderly world. Worst case scenario, Hiroto would use them as bait. The map provided by the shogunate had shown a small village at the edge of the forest, so Hiroto had picked that as their destination. Upon arrival, it had proven even more pathetic than expected, simply a collection of rotten huts and stinking pig pens. Yet it would provide a final opportunity to restock their provisions. Hiroto also hoped for first-hand information. The villagers saw the warriors approaching and abandoned their fields to hide in their huts. That was not surprising. Villages like this were often menaced by one conquering army or another, and during times of peace, there were always bandits. One farmer remained in the center of the village to greet them. That would be their appointed headman, the presenter of taxes and hospitality. The rest of you hang back for a moment. There's no need to spook them further. Of course, the shogun's representative did not listen. When Hiroto dismounted and began walking into the village, Ashikaga Motokane followed, swaggering in the most intimidating way possible.
I need to ask these farmers some questions. Why bother? They'll know nothing. You might be surprised. Motokane looked upon the village with disgust. They're beneath us. We're authorized to take whatever supplies we require. Let's do it and get on with it. It was no wonder the poor farmers saw little difference between bandits and samurai. The headman had seen their banner bore the shogunate's mon, and as they approached, had already launched into a rapid speech, telling them how wonderful they were. But that his poor village had paid its taxes, and for them to please have mercy, because the terrible heat had caused their crops to wilt, and their well to run dry, so on and so forth. Hiroto didn't have patience for such frivolous things, when there were monsters about, so he cut the headman off. I am Nasu Hiroto. We've come to kill the Oni of Aokigahara.
You are not the first. The stories are true. Our land is cursed. It is a terrible scourge. We are so thankful more brave samurai have come to fight the demon.
Only the headman didn't actually sound relieved. If anything, he was annoyed.
Many of you have come through here this summer, eating our food, putting our men to work as guides.
Yes, I know. The village had probably seen a parade of warriors by this point, but he needed information. Have you seen it yourself?
No, but I have felt it watching. Many have, though. Young Hagi saw it first, perched high in the trees, shaped like a man, but bigger, with a head like an ox. She thought it was an angry ghost and ran away. Old Genzo saw it, too. He heard the thunder when it killed the first samurai. It put the three sparks on him, too, but Genzo fled before more lightning came. Lucky it didn't chase him, because it is swift as a horse.
Any creature capable of effortlessly slaughtering samurai would have an easy time with a place this defenseless. How many of your people has the demon killed?
Who cares? Motokane said. They're just peasants.
The headman looked nervously between the two imposing warriors, unsure whether he was still supposed to speak or not. Hiroto wished that Motokane would keep his idiot mouth shut. These farmers were probably as frightened by hungry soldiers as the demon plaguing their woods. I must know. How many of you have died?
It is hard to believe, but none, noble samurai. He has only attacked mighty warriors such as you. Our village has not been troubled by three sparks.
That name would suffice. All of those men beheaded or skinned nearby, yet this three sparks has not harmed a single person in this humble village. Curious.
Perhaps they're in league with the Oni, Motokane snarled. Why else would it leave them be?
The headman immediately threw himself into the dust and began begging for mercy, which with a hothead like Motokane was certainly the wisest thing possible.
No, please, we would never. After the killing started, some of us left offerings at the shrine to appease it at most.
You gave gifts to a demon that was killing my brothers? Motokane bellowed as he reached for a sword. Hiroto sighed. Clan officials always made his job more complicated. He wasn't going to get any answers if Motokane started slaughtering villages. Please calm yourself.
The Shogun will abide no treachery.
And I will not abide you interrupting me again. The official may have outranked him, but Hiroto was the one hand-picked for this assignment, and his patience was wearing thin. You said it yourself. Peasants are beneath your notice. You and three sparks have that in common. Now walk away and let me finish. Motokane was quarrelsome, but he wasn't stupid. Rank had privileges, but they were a long way from Kamakura. The young man gave the headman one last threatening glare, then let go of his sword and went back to join his troops.
Good.
Hiroto didn't particularly want to murder him, but he would if necessary. And then simply tell the Shogun that the demon had gotten him.
Now where were we? I'm sorry, great and noble, enough groveling.
And stand already.
I'm no tax collector. He waited for the farmer to get up. I'm simply a hunter. And you're going to tell me everything you know about this demon, so that I can kill it. It was hard to tell over the clanking and huffing of Motokane's bodyguards, but beyond them the forest was unnaturally quiet. The wind did not penetrate far into the sea of trees. There were no birds singing, no insects buzzing, just the occasional tap of collected humidity falling on leaves. It was no wonder the place had been considered haunted even before an Oni had moved in. That morning the others had dressed for war. Motokane's retinue were wearing their armor and helmets, with bows strung, spears held high, and their swords at their sides. The shogun's finest looked like fearsome combatants, a worthy challenge for any demon. Meanwhile, Hiroto lagged behind them, unarmed and stripped to the waist, with a bamboo pole balanced across his shoulder, with a bundle hanging from each end. He had even gone and rolled about in the fields to complete the act. The other samurai thought he'd gone mad when he left his swords behind. But Hiroto looked and even smelled like a local farmer. Hiroto tried to appear inconsequential, head down, tired and stumbling from rock to rock beneath his clumsy burden. He would be no threat, especially to a mighty Oni. He was simply a porter, conscripted from the village to carry his betters' supplies because the forest was too rugged for their horses. The headman had told him that some of the other would-be demon hunters had done the same, and each time their porter had come running back alone, terrified, sometimes covered in blood, but alive. In his experience, most beasts targeted the weakest prey. This Oni was different. It attacked the strong. He would use that to his advantage. They walked for hours. It was slow going across such rough terrain. Thick roots waited to trip them. Each warrior was drenched in sweat. The air felt heavy and smelled of moss. The soil was dark and littered with black volcanic rocks. Between the heat and the uneven ground, the samurai were surely regretting wearing their armor. But they were all too proud to show it. Each of them thought that they would be the one to take the trophy back to their lord, and they passed the time by boasting of what they would do with their reward. Hiroto just kept his head down, appearing meek and subservient. He reasoned it did not do much good to use his eyes to hunt a creature which was supposedly invisible. Instead, he listened. In a forest without sound, the faintest things became audible. The Oni was quiet, but not as quiet as a tiger. In trees packed too tight for the wind to rustle through, the smallest movement was a clue. Occasionally he'd hear flesh scrape against bark, or the creak of a branch as weight settled on it. There was another sound beneath as well, barely audible, but unnatural. Like the chittering of an insect, combined with the slithering of a snake across sand. It made the hair on his arms stand up. All of that information would have been lost amongst the noise of a living place, but in the haunted stillness of Aokigahara, it told a story. They were being followed. It was somewhere above them and to the right. He tried not to let his excitement show. "Over here," Kaneto called from the edge of a nearby stream. "There's another." This body had been there for a few days, and was missing its head. But from his fine clothing and the broken katana lying in the water, he had clearly been a samurai. Motokane knelt next to the corpse and pointed at the emblem embroidered on the sleeve. "I recognize this from court. This is the personal mon of Hojo Murashiga." Hiroto had no idea who that was, but the Hojo were a family of some importance. The corpse's identity seemed to shake the others. "He was a fearsome swordsman," Zensuka whispered. "The best of us. It didn't just take his head. It ripped out his spine." Motokane stood up and glanced around nervously. A full day of nerves and stress had worn him thin. He suddenly raised his voice and bellowed,
Show yourself, demon! Show yourself so I can kill you like the wretched, cowardly dog you are!